On this episode of Skeptico, I talk with Roy Davis about his book, The Darwin Conspiracy. This is either an incredible coincidence or something more. Darwin has this explosion of ideas, announces to his colleagues that he's had this incredible breakthrough during these 2 weeks that are in question about when he received the letter from Wallace. It's also an incredible coincidence, if we're to believe the status quo traditional story, that they would both focus in and this idea would crystallize for both of them exactly at the same time. I mean, it's either an incredible coincidence or it's something more. It's plagiarism, as you suggest.
The story is just too much to believe. Darwin's own history in this area is suspect. For people to claim that this was a coincidence is just outlandish. There is no point, and other academics in the book that I quote say this, there is no point at which Darwin's research comes before Wallace's ideas.
Stay with us for Skeptico.
Welcome to Skeptico, where we explore controversial science with leading researchers, thinkers, and their critics. I'm your host, Alex Sikaris, and on this episode, a show I've been waiting a long time to do. Roy Davis's book was introduced to me by a longtime member of the Skeptico Forum, and his ideas have stuck in my head ever since. It was a delight to talk to him and bring to light his amazing discoveries about the true history of the theory of evolution. Today we welcome Roy Davis to Skeptico. Roy is a former BBC filmmaker and journalist and author of The Darwin Conspiracy, Origins of a Scientific Crime. Roy, welcome to Skeptico. Thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you, Alex.
As I was just mentioning a minute ago, Roy, I have to tell you, this book of yours, to me, is one of the most underappreciated books I've run across, because the implications of your theory, if they're true, and I think they are quite dramatic. So let me, as a way of an introduction, if you will, let me kind of lay out a very thumbnail sketch of the theory. You claim that Charles Darwin, that God among gods of science,
yes, indeed, demigod,
while he was toiling away on this theory of evolution, he received this gift, this wonderful boost in the form of a letter from a guy who was also working on the theory of evolution, a guy who's acknowledged as the co-discoverer of the theory of evolution, that being Alfred Russell Wallace. Mm-hmm. And you claim that Darwin stole, plagiarized some of the key elements of his theory, really the springboard to rejuvenate this work he'd been doing, from Alfred Russell Wallace, and then that he lied about it. Is that the gist of your claim?
Yes.
Okay, simple enough. So tell us a little bit about your background and how you got to become interested in this part of history.
Okay. Right, let's start at the beginning. My primary training was as a journalist, as a cub journalist on a newspaper in South Wales in Britain. And one of the most important lessons that I learned at that stage was from a senior reporter who said to me quite simply, look, from now on, do not accept any story that you are told by less than two people. Meaning, if one person tells you a story, you go out and check it with somebody else who doesn't know that person and make sure it's the right story. Otherwise, we are all going to be in trouble in this newspaper. And that stayed with me as a pretty good line about how to approach stories. Eventually, I left journalism, went back to college, joined the BBC, and after some years, I became the managing director or the managing editor of history programs at the BBC. And one day, I asked one of my producers to come in and see me, and he said he wanted to make a program about Charles Darwin. A new book had been written. This was 1990-1991. And the new book had been written about Charles Darwin. He wanted to make a program about it. I didn't know much about Charles Darwin, except the theory of evolution, and I wanted to learn as much as he knew. So I said, okay, it's a good story. Let's make it. And he came back later with a very good program, which went out on the BBC under my name as editor, and his name. And that program was called The Devil's Chaplain, C-H-A-P-L-A-I-N. And it went down very well indeed. And a few years later, I left the BBC, and a woman producer from Wales came up to me and said, you made the Darwin program. And I said, yes. And she said, she said, you told the wrong story. And that flummoxed me totally, because I said, what do you mean you told the wrong story? It's the story that everybody knows. And she said, yes, of course it is. It's the story everybody's been told and everybody's bought into. It's not the correct story. In fact, you never mentioned Alfred Russel Wallace. And that hit me, because I thought, well, who the hell is this guy? You know, I had no idea, because it didn't appear in the program. And so from that moment on, I started research into Alfred Russel Wallace. And what I found just flabbergasted me. Just one thing after another came out of the actual papers and documents of the time, which I could not have expected, and led me to write the book.
Yeah, that's quite a story. I love that. The journalist whose journalistic sensibilities are challenged by someone who comes up and says, you didn't get the story right. And then you have the integrity to say, gee, if I didn't get the story right, I have to pursue that. So before we talk about what you've discovered, the evidence for it, what some of your critics have said, which I think is very important, I'd love to do that on the show.
By all means.
Let's talk about why this is important, because a lot of people would love to make this about religion, baby Jesus, Bible, creationism. That's where a lot of the critics, especially Roy, folks here in the States, they'd like to take it there because it's an easy argument to win. They can just label you as some kind of creationist, some guy who has some agenda, religious agenda, and that's what this is all about. So let's just get that out in front, front right away.
The my stance personally is that I have no religion. I am totally irreligious person. I have no belief at all in the afterlife, God, creator, whatever. None. This is simply about two men. This is about two men who, more or less at the same time in different parts of the world, were trying to do the same thing. One here in Britain, the other one floating around the world in different locations. And for me, the connection between these two men, who never met in the years that they were trying to prove the same thing, only afterwards did they meet. These two men, the story between the holes between them at a distance of something like 8,000 miles became such an interesting story that I just couldn't put it down. And so the research took me on and off 12 years and resulted in the book that you've got in front of you there.
Great. And we might also add that this theory and the way this little battle competition plays out is that Darwinian evolution has become the lens through which science sees the world. And, you know, we spend a lot of time on this show, on Skeptico, investigating issues around human consciousness. Because if you want to look at big picture science questions, you know, the who are we, why are we here kind of questions, you always come back to the question of consciousness. Am I a biological robot? Is there a me in there? Is my brain just creating this illusion of me? That question is at the bedrock of every question that science asks. And I think Darwinian evolution is really the foundational pillar in this pronouncement, this position that you are just a biological robot and a meaningless part of the nature's machine kind of worldview. So whatever we make of that, whether you buy into that or you don't buy into it, I think we have to say that that's why this is important, because that's what Darwinian evolution has become.
Absolutely.
What I wanted to do then was say, you know, we have reason to look at this a little deeper, and I think ask some bigger questions about why this matters, about why we should probe so deeply into the kind of questions that you raise. Because I think as we dig into the evidence, which is what I'd like to do next, I'd like to have people continue asking in the back of their mind, well, why does this matter? Who cares? And the question is, why do I live in the world that I live in? And I think hopefully at the end of this, Roy, we can come back and re-examine some of those questions after we look at, most importantly, the evidence. We have to find out if you really did discover anything, if this theory of yours makes any sense and how it stands up to the critics. So let's start with the letter. What is the letter?
There were two letters. And once upon a time, I thought that I might call this program Two Letters for Mr. Darwin. Because basically, the whole point of this story revolves about when Alfred Russel Wallace made his discoveries and how much later on Charles Darwin claimed those discoveries as his own. And there were two different letters. One was sent in October 1856, and that was including Wallace's own ideas about the basic tools, if you like, of evolution. And the second one was sent in March 1858, and that became the famous letter that Darwin claimed he received 2 weeks later than he did, in order that he could then fill up 66 pages of his ongoing natural, ongoing thesis, if you like, the manuscript he was then writing.
His journal, right? His journal entries, right?
It wasn't his journal. This was the natural selection manuscript that he was then completing, that Lyle had suggested he do some years before. And in that manuscript, he introduced 66 pages of information about the theory of divergence, which Wallace by this time had sent him and cleared up a huge amount of information and selection about this. And Darwin then copied it into his natural selection manuscript and claimed it that he'd had it there for some time. And then he announced that he'd had a letter from Darwin, from Wallace, which in fact, of course, he'd had in his own collection for about 2 weeks. And it was that letter that became the famous letter which started the whole Linnaean procedure off in London on the 1st of July, 1858, at which Wallace and Darwin were given the accolade of being the discoverers of the theory of evolution, but Charles Darwin's name was put first. And hence, Charles Darwin and Wallace as the discoverers eventually became Charles Darwin, the discoverer of evolution, and Wallace's name was forgotten.
Okay, I want to pore over the details of some of that because they're obviously very important. First, I want to talk about this two-week difference.
Yes.
You alluded to the fact that we can trace a significant amount of new work that Darwin adds to his body of work during that two-week period. Can you tell us why we know that we can trace a lot of Darwin's writings to that two-week period? How do we know that?
Okay. Basically, what he wrote in those 66 pages only came out when Origin of Species was published in 1859. Before that, at the Linnaean, nothing was referred to in terms of these 66 pages of new information. Darwin didn't present those pages to Hooker or Lyle in his case for claiming the theory of evolution as his own. No, and Lyle and Hooker never knew that that had taken place. They just were not informed. And so it was important because Darwin knew at the back of his theory, he had these 66 new pages of Wallace's information taken from, I believe, Wallace's own outline of his theory and copied them into his book. So what he was doing, really, was taking stuff that Wallace had sent him and putting it into his own manuscript and claiming it as his own. That was the plagiarism charge. That was the idea that he had stolen Wallace's idea. Now, Wallace, of course, sent the letter to Darwin completely innocently. I mean, he just wanted Darwin's approval, if you like, of the fact that he'd come up with the theory of evolution. And when Darwin got the letter, I think he panicked, started writing it into his manuscript, a few days later claimed to Hooker that in fact he now had the as the central part of his theory, Wallace's idea. But he didn't say it was Wallace's idea, he said it was his own. So that divergence became the thing which allowed both Lyell and Hooker to believe that Darwin had come up with this theory on his own, and now he was going to lose out because Wallace had sent him the letter, which he then produced 2 weeks later. I think the evidence I've offered proves it, that in fact Darwin at that point reached the lowest ebb that he'd reached, and he had a long time before started doing this sort of stuff to other people at different times. It wasn't the first time that he cheated.
And even your critics, while they might not agree on that last point, mm-hmm. that Darwin had a history of fudging with his sources,
yes.
there is agreement on the fact that this is either an incredible coincidence or something more. It's a coincidence that Darwin has this explosion of ideas, announces to his colleagues that he's had this incredible breakthrough during these 2 weeks that are in question about when he received the letter from Wallace. It's also an incredible coincidence, if we're to believe the status quo traditional story, that Wallace would be this co-discoverer right alongside Darwin, who was kind of puttering around with these ideas, that they would both focus in and this idea would crystallize for both of them exactly at the same time, given the length of time that it takes for this correspondence to go back and forth. I mean, it's either an incredible coincidence or it's something more. It's plagiarism, as you suggest. Can we at least boil it down to that? I mean, we do have to agree that There's no other way to explain that.
I would say that the story of coincidentality, if there is such a word, is just too much to believe. Darwin's own history in this area is suspect. For people to claim that this was a coincidence is just outlandish. There is no point, and I make this point in the book, there is no point, and other academics in the book that I quote say this, there is no point at which Darwin's research comes before Wallace's ideas. Wallace's ideas, from the time that he goes to South America and then eventually onto the Malay archipelago, he is sending ideas back, which Darwin then finds a way of getting into his own research. It never happens the other way around.
Right. Although some of your critics have suggested that that did happen, and that one of your critics says that Darwin even writes in his journal at an undated entry, I might add, which is highly suspicious, but that Darwin is commenting about Wallace's paper and he says nothing new. The point being, there's nothing new here from Wallace.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. That's absolutely true. And they were writing about the Sarawak Law in September 1855, which Wallace had published in the Annals and History of Natural History. And basically, what Darwin did was, when he read this, he claimed in the marginal notes that he was making that there is nothing new here. And to show that there was nothing new, he actually put a straight marginal line down against 35 of Wallace's paragraphs in his own copy of that law, and indicating thereby that he found each of those paragraphs of interest. It wasn't just a question of him writing one thing down saying there's nothing of interest here. Why would he write lines, perpendicular lines, and sometimes more than one on each paragraph down throughout that piece of Wallace's in the Annals? It is unlikely. And not only unlikely, but somebody's got to explain more than just that why would he make the lines? Why would he indicate the paragraphs had some significance? Each one of them. 35 different ones in that piece.
And I think, as you alluded to just a minute ago, I think the strongest circumstantial evidence is the rush to publication, right? I mean, here's a guy who's been dillying around with this stuff for years, hasn't put it together, and now he gets this letter and there's this rush to get it to publication. And he even brings along Wallace, which, as you read it, is somewhat of almost a guilt exercise, you know. But clearly, as you said, Wallace is somewhat naive in writing the letter to Darwin and saying, hey, you're an upper crust kind of guy with all the right connections. Maybe you can help me get this published. And he's handing it over to a guy who says, oh my gosh, here's the stuff. And then there's this tremendous rush to get it to publication. Is that right?
Well, the story's been told before about Mozart and Salieri, and it's almost exactly the same story. Somebody who wants something so desperately, and yet somebody else has it. How on earth do you go about getting that for yourself? And Darwin managed to do it. He managed to convince people, because he was upper crust, and because he and Wallace had exchanged letters before this. And Wallace didn't know anybody in the upper crust section of British society, certainly not the scientific society, except his own agent, Samuel Stevens. And it was Stevens who kept on sending him notes saying, look, will you stop theorizing, please? You know, everybody here wants you just to collect things and send them back. And of course, Wallace's whole instinct was, how on earth do animals, does life change in each generation? Or how do the generations change inside particular species? And he was he who actually found all this and put it together. And then because he had corresponding with Darwin, first of all, he sent Darwin a letter. Darwin replied, saying to him, oh, we thought much alike. In fact, it was obvious when Lyell went to see him that they had not thought much alike. And yet Darwin convinced Wallace they thought much alike. Wallace had his own suspicions that they hadn't, but then he sends another letter back to Darwin, and then Darwin replies. And the last letter of the five of them was the one where Wallace actually says to him, look, I've come up with a theory of evolution. Would you have a look at it? And if you think it's good enough, will you show it to Charles Lyell? And that's where the story sort of gets bogged down in the whole question of what was in that letter, because it doesn't exist anymore. Charles Darwin made sure that the letters don't exist anymore, not only to Wallace, but to all the significant characters who might have offered some kind of criticism of what he was doing, particularly people like Asa Gray in Boston, you know, I mean, who none of Darwin's letters, none of Gray's letters to Darwin stay alive, are in extant at this moment. But Darwin's letters to Gray are, and in those letters, he gives the game away. So basically, we know for a fact that there's something seriously wrong with this story. I mean, people who love Darwin and are Darwinists keep on saying, but you can't prove it, you can't prove it. And that's partly because, Darwin destroyed the evidence which might have been able to bring him down. But that isn't the only evidence we've got. We've got a lot of evidence, mostly that Wallace's ideas were, first of all, rubbished by Darwin and then taken and made into his own.
Right. And we should mention, as long as you're talking about it, what letters meant during this time period. Because send off an email and we throw it in our trash and we don't think anything of it. Letters of this kind, to be lost, to be thrown away, is virtually unheard of for a scientist like Darwin, right?
Indeed. Darwin keeps all the letters, like for his son going to the university or the Ashmolean Museum or whatever. I mean, he keeps those letters, but the significant ones are not there. But the letters themselves, you see, this is the most important part. Everything hinges in this story, and this is the difficult bit of getting across to people. Everything in this story hinges eventually on two things. One is the mail service between Singapore and home. When it happened, how it happened, which ships took the mail, which ships were meant to take the mail, and which ships actually carried the mail. The second part of it is the whole idea of letters themselves and their significance in the middle of the 19th century. The whole idea of letters coming from an area of the world where the British were in China in trouble with the Chinese uprising against their attempt attempt to sort of keep hold of bits of China, which they shouldn't have done. And the second part was the whole Indian mutiny, which began in 1857, which had been boiling since 1856. And those two things made the mail from Singapore home the most important channel of information for anybody to do with governing the British in India or in China.
Okay, so let's put an exclamation point on that. Mail service is the internet, the railroad, the highway system, all wrapped together for the British Empire. It's the way the whole thing runs back then.
Absolutely.
And most importantly, what you reveal in this book and through your research is that there is really no way that Darwin could have gotten the letter on the day when he said he did. It really doesn't make any sense. And as a matter of fact, even your critics agree that it would be a highly unusual set of circumstances for it to arrive on that day. And the reason for that is because, as you just said, the mail at this point in history is a regularly scheduled event. And when it comes from the other side of the world, we can trace down when that happened. Why do you think it's so unlikely that Charles Darwin received that letter on the date that he said he did?
Okay, no, there's no likelihood at all. One of my critics is John Van Wy, who is now in Singapore, who is a Darwin enthusiast. Now, the point of John Van Wy is making is that John, because he needs it to happen in the middle of the month, gets the first boat to pick up the mail and take it to Singapore, totally without precedent.
Well, we can jump in there, and I can shut that down. Right? I mean, if there's a better example of apologetics, I don't know where it is. If there's a better example of Dr. John Van Wy starting with the conclusion that he wants and then working backwards to try and make it fit the circumstances that we know, it's just
true.
Absurd. Where, if you could spend a minute, tell us why he's jumping through all these hoops. Because, as I understand it, the reason he's jumping through all these hoops is that the regularly scheduled mail, the mail that gets reported in the newspaper around the world, would not put the letter there at the time that Darwin claims that it's there, right?
Let me come the other way around. The mail coming back from the Far East, from Singapore, there were two deliveries a month from Singapore to Britain. There had only been, in 56, one a month. But the British, because of the connection with the India and China, were in desperate need of having a more regular service to find out exactly what was happening. They didn't know what their army was doing. They didn't know what was happening in the Indian Revolution, in the mutiny. Nobody had any idea until the mail came in. And so that made the biggest thing on the headlines in the Times of London every 2 weeks was the mail has arrived. It's the most amazing piece of news. It always led the papers on that day. Now then, the mail that came from the archipelago, the May archipelago, where Wallace was at the time he discovered the theory, always came from the archipelago to Britain and arrived on the second day or the third day of every month. The second delivery always ended up in the middle of the month, but that middle of the month mail never included mail from the archipelago. Now, John Van Wy insists that the mail from the archipelago arrived on June the 18th. And I'm saying that because of what I know about the schedule of boats in the Far East at that time, that letter, posted on the 9th of March, 1858, arrived on June the 2nd in London, on June the 3rd in Darwin's home. And it was for that reason that for the next 2 weeks, Darwin had the chance to introduce into his natural selection manuscript the 66 pages of new information that he had taken from Wallace's own theory. And that's why he was able to say to Lyell in his letters, look, this is appalling. I've worked on this for years, and here I get a letter from Wallace saying exactly the same things. His ideas could stand as headlines to my chapters, or words to that effect.
Oh my gosh, that is amazing.
You know? And that's what he did. And when John Van Wy insists that the mail only came on the 18th, it is because he does not understand that the two firms taking and bringing mail from Singapore were two entirely different firms, and that one brought it and one took it. So the firm he's talking about actually took the mail from Singapore and delivered it to Narthe and to the archipelago. I'm saying that the other firm fetched the mail from the archipelago, from the firm at Surabaya on Java, delivered it first to Jakarta, which was then Batavia, and then to Singapore. So one firm took it, and one firm delivered it. And the firm that delivered it always delivered the mail that ended up on the second of every month in London, unless there was some small discrepancy either way because of tides or weather or whatever.
And I really like the way, Roy, that you laid that out from the big picture standpoint, because people really get a sense that even if you're going to make this claim that the letter arrived 2 weeks later, you have to acknowledge that this is a rare occurrence. So to add to all the other amazing coincidences, you have to add the fact that, hey, the letters from that territory never arrived on the 18th.
It never did.
Arrived at the beginning of the month.
It never did. And do you know something? The strange thing is that John Van Wyk calls me a conspiracy theorist because I don't agree with him on when the mail arrived. And yet, not one academic has yet challenged me to go through the points I make in the book and discuss whether I'm right or wrong. You know, I'm a conspiracy theorist. What a conspiracy theorist is somebody who makes up a theory which is not borne out by the facts. This isn't true about this book. You know, every fact in that book is checked and with references at the back to everybody who's made the statements, and they're not me.
The irony, of course, is that's what this story is really about.
Yes, indeed.
It's all about a conspiracy. And it's further evidence of what I always say on this show over and over again, is that if you're ever around power and money, you realize that everything is a conspiracy. Everything that's really important.
I like you. You're a nice cynic. You're a bit like me.
Well, it's true. I mean, if you're just playing a small-time game that no one cares about and you just have a day-to-day job and, you know, life doesn't seem like a conspiracy.
Right.
But as you move up into where the real power and the money is, my background is in business, and I tell people all the time, hey, as I got into bigger and bigger deals, it was always a conspiracy. Well, don't tell this person that. What kind of information can we get that they don't know? It's always a conspiracy. So the whole idea of a conspiracy theory is really kind of laughable. But as this story plays out, it's a perfect example of course, Darwin is involved in a conspiracy. And of course, that language he's talking about is conspiratorial. Even at its surface, it's conspiratorial. And he's telling his colleagues that I've gotten this letter and it's going to squash all my work. Well, that's a conspiracy, right? He's working kind of behind the scenes. We have to get my paper out to the conference before this. All that's a conspiracy. It's an open conspiracy.
It is indeed. And do you know something which is very interesting? John Brooks, who I met before he died, who was one of the people who helped me in the first instance to get hold of this this idea properly. John Brooks tried very hard to establish exactly when and where the post came from Indonesia, and made a big mistake. He wasn't helped by a professor in Holland, as I was, to get the dates right. And so he imagined that the date may have been May the 18th that the letter came, you know, and he put that as a possibility. And people jumped on him. I mean, especially some people in America. They jumped on him and really ruined his reputation, saying, you know, I mean, absolutely rubbish. It couldn't have been. That left the field in a difficult place for me, but I did know that the second letter, that the one we've just been talking about, coming at the beginning of the month, was one thing. But what nobody had picked up, and which is why I really got interested in the story, is I just wondered why nobody had picked up the fact that Wallace had sent his previous letter to Darwin in October 1856, which should have arrived on January the 3rd, 1857. That post actually arrived 11 days late because of storms. Darwin claimed he didn't receive that letter for 4 months. And 4 months later, he had put into his own work both the idea of what divergence meant, right, as a theory, which is very important, and Wallace's second statement, which was that new species and strongly marked varieties. Then Darwin took that and in the first instance wrote it into his journal, into his manuscript that he was writing. The second thing he sent to Hooker as an idea which had just crossed his mind.
Well, you know, and that brings us back, if we will, to the implications for this. Because when we look back through the lens of history and look back at this, it's stunning what this has meant for us. It's really about worldview. It's about which one wins out. I had an interesting interview a while back with a Wallace biographer named Professor Michael Flannery.
Oh, yes.
What Flannery helped me see is that what Wallace saw and what Darwin didn't see is that it's not about survival. It's about non-survival.
Yes.
So it's not about an individual surviving or striving to survive. It's about who doesn't survive, who is the least fit. You don't have to be the best. You just can't fall into the bottom
10%.
And the other thing that Darwin was so wrong about, and the implications for the world we live in are just stunning, but it's not about individual survival.
No, it's not.
It's about the group and whether my group survives and is able to carry these genes forward. It's about cooperation among the group, which Wallace found all over the place. And part of this goes back to the point that you made about who these people were. I mean, Alfred Russel Wallace, as you alluded to, was a working guy.
Yep.
Who was collecting samples so that he could send them back and sell them to keep his life going.
That was his job.
And he was also a guy that collected thousands and thousands, over 250,000 samples. So he saw a bigger field, a bigger playing field, that you can start to draw these conclusions about what does this worldview mean in terms of how it's worked its way into our culture. Our culture is about individual survival. It's about, although Darwin can't be credited with coining the term, it's about survival of the fittest. And we use that over and over and over again in every aspect of our endeavors to justify what we do and how we do it. That, to me, is why all this is so important, because when we reflect back on what it means about the world we live in, it's really kind of stunning.
Yes, indeed. One of the points you just said, I'm not quite sure about whether you may be right, but Wallace showed us that it was the most subtle, the smallest, the least observable change in one individual in any society, which gives him an advantage or her an advantage in the general way of life, that allows that particular advantage to be passed on. Eventually, a group can be formed from that individual advantage.
Well, I don't know, and I don't think that that's necessarily inconsistent with what Flannery's saying. But Flannery's point, I think, to me, was quite profound in that what he said in really digging into Wallace's writings was that Wallace found that it was competition occurring among groups in a demographic sense that really ultimately made the difference, made the leap forward. And I don't think that's inconsistent with what you're saying, because an individual change can then benefit the group, and then the group can win out. But what he saw, and I think this is obvious to all of us just looking at it, is that if your individual change doesn't benefit your group, then you're really not going to advance and survive, because it is, at the end of the day, it's about whether your tribe advances. You can't do it alone.
No, I agree. I didn't understand exactly. Right, now you've explained that, I understand. Because the group eventually has to perform as a group against any other group seeking the same kind of food or same kind of place or whatever.
Exactly. It becomes obvious once we think it through. But if we just look at Darwin, Darwin was really saying something different. And it was partly because of the way he was collecting samples, and he wasn't collecting as many samples, and he was only collecting them on the Galapagos. What he saw is that, hey, you know, whoever is the most fit will get the right to breed, and their offspring will regenerate and all that stuff, which is true. But what he didn't do was pull the lens back a little bit and say, okay, so now I have these hyenas here, this tribe, but if they can't succeed in the overall environment that they're in, then it doesn't go forward as a group. It can't be just about that one individual. That one individual change then changes the group.
Yes.
But whether or not the genes ultimately go forward is whether or not that group is successful.
Okay. Now, one thing that worries me a little that you just said is that Darwin's theory of evolution, and I've got to object on that one. I don't think it is Darwin's theory of evolution. I think it's I think it's Wallace's theory of evolution.
Right.
Sorry, I mean, I know everybody in the world thinks it's Darwin's theory, but I actually don't think it's Darwin's theory. I think Darwin pinched it from Wallace and didn't have a theory of his own at all.
Roy, tell me this. What has it been like for you pursuing this research? It's obviously you're a guy who's not afraid from a little bit of confrontation, and we're all benefiting from the fact that you are not shy about that. But what has this been like for you to go through this?
I have to tell you that I've enjoyed every minute of it. I think the odds are fair, you see. I think me against the rest is fair odds. If it was two of me and the rest, I mean, that wouldn't be fair. But I mean, because I am who I am, because I don't tend to give up on things, you know, no matter what Van Wy says or Charles Smith says, or, you know, I mean, what even people who are, well, I don't know many other people who are, well, people like the former Oxford professor, you know, who's also said that I don't know what I'm talking about. Also, all sorts of people say I don't know what I'm talking about. Not one of them will actually take it on as a frontal attack.
Isn't that amazing? I've run across that so many times. You know, it's a lot of talk until it gets down to, okay, let's square off. And then it's, well, like, it's not even worth my time to debate it.
Well, exactly. And I've actually been in a debate with one of the people who are against what I say, mostly about the shipping and the letters. And the letters start, and we talk to each other. I make points, he makes points. And eventually I say something like, well, look, don't you think that given all my objections to your objections and all the points that I'm making, which refer to yours, don't you think that we should that you should actually come out and say that you don't want to throw people, sand in people's eyes anymore? And it stopped, never came back, simply because the last challenge is the one which says, look, please, you know, if I'm wrong, tell me I'm wrong because I've got the wrong facts, but don't tell me I'm wrong because you think it might be something else. You know, and because I'm so, well, I'm stuck now with this idea of Roy Davis, the conspiracy theorist, that, you know, whenever anybody gives me a chance to talk about it, I will. But having talked about it now for 5 years, you know, and still got nowhere with people who really don't want to believe and have spurious ideas why they can't be right, you know, slowly I'm coming to the point where maybe there's something else in life without going on about, you know, Wallace and Darwin. Not that I would ever not talk about Wallace, but really talking about Darwin seems to me to be counterproductive.
There's a dilemma, right? I mean, you reach a point where you have to tire a little bit of the topic. And when you see that progress isn't being made, you say, okay, let me move on. And then, of course, this is what the critics wait for, because then, of course, they'll pronounce the idea dead and that you don't even pursue it anymore.
Exactly. Yes, you've got it. So why do you think I was so pleased that you wanted to talk to me?
It's an idea that will live on for as long as people are willing to pursue it in an open, honest, fair-minded way, because when they do, they can really come to no other conclusion. But as we know, as I've explored so many times on this show, to folks who are married to a particular worldview, who have a lot of personal investment in believing things are a certain way, well, it's going to be very frustrating, because it's going to be frustrating for you and frustrating for them. They're going to dismiss it out of hand, and you're never going to hear from them again.
Well, I don't mind. I don't mind. What is good? What is good about the world and good about the internet age and the whole modern ways of communication is that you don't have to wait for a letter for 6 weeks from India, but you can actually phone somebody from San Diego, find out what they're saying in London, and then tell people in South Africa what's happening. If that is the way the thing goes, then I'm all for it, you know. And if somebody wants to get in touch with me and say I'm wrong, or they can prove that I'm wrong or show that I'm wrong, then quite happily I'll answer them.
Well, you know, Roy, that might be a very nice way to wrap things out. It kind of brings full circle letter communications and communication gaps, and how maybe the internet is partially can play a role in that solution of tightening those communication gaps. So you mentioned it a little bit in passing that you're still interested in this work, but there isn't a lot of work going forward. What other things are you involved with right now? What projects are you working on?
I'm not. This, as I told you, with the woman from Wales who said I told the wrong story, this pretty well dominated the next 12 years of my life. And the last 5 years since the book was published, I've pretty well given lectures all over the place. Not to much avail. People still believe that Darwin is the king and Wallace was very much an inferior prince. But where I am at the moment is thinking about a screenplay, although one of my colleagues is suggesting a screenplay about the Wallace Darwin story, but I'm not sure that works, but that's one way. But I trained as a screenwriter a couple of years ago, and so I'm just thinking of something which is such a good idea that people can't resist it. And that's going to take a long time. So it could be ages before you hear from me again.
Well, I hope it isn't that long. It's an idea and a book that, as I said right from the beginning, is one of the most underappreciated works that I've seen, and the implications are just dramatic. The name of the book, again, is The Darwin Conspiracy, Origins of a Scientific Crime. Our guest has been Roy Davis. Roy, thanks so much for joining me today on Skeptico.
Thank you very much, Alex.
Thanks again to Roy Davis for joining me today on Skeptico. When we're off the air, Roy made a very, very generous offer to Skeptico listeners, and I wanted to pass that along to you. Roy told me that even though this book is very, very hard to come by, he has a number of copies that he'd be willing to give away for free, as long as you cover his postage. So if you want to email me, I will send you Roy's email address as a way to get in contact with him, and you can take him up on that generous offer. Okay, just one question to tee up from this interview. Did Darwin plagiarize the work of Alfred Russel Wallace? It seems clear to me that he did, but I'd like to hear your opinion, including your opinion on Roy Davis's critics, who are out there and are quite vocal as well. Let me know your thoughts. The place to do it is through the Skeptico website at skeptiko.com. From there, you'll find a link to our forum, a comment section on the website, Facebook email link to me, and all that good stuff. You'll also find over 250 previous episodes of Skeptico, where you can download them all for free or subscribe on iTunes. Love to have you do that. Love to hear about folks who are catching up on all the old episodes and enjoying that little time capsule that's been created out there. Number of interesting shows coming up. I won't go through all of them with you, but I'll just try and get them out to you so you can enjoy them as much as I enjoy bringing them to you. That's it for this episode. Take care, and bye for now.